Well, thank you very much indeed, John, and for Alan and everybody else for inviting me to speak at what is going to be clearly a very interesting, topical and important conference. I'm sure it wasn't the organisers' intention, however, that this conference is taking place at a very important time or a very important week, and it's not just Wimbledon week I'm thinking of. I'm thinking about what's going on the industrial front in the United Kingdom and in particularly in England and Wales at the moment, because we're going to see the largest public sector strike for three decades. And this follows a very large demonstration that took place in London in March against the cuts in earlier this year. The present dispute is taking place when employees in the public sector have seen colleagues dismissed, vital services cut, pensions eroded, and pay rises frozen, and inflation is still running at about 5%. So it's in this context, it seems very appropriate to talk this afternoon about something which is clearly the flagship policy of the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition government, because it has implications for us all, but in particular for those who are engaged in working communities, community development in particular, and higher education, the courses that are delivering the programs for which people qualify to work in community development. Before I go any further, though, I'd like to acknowledge that there are differences clearly between the four countries in the UK, and they are at different stages, and I don't profess to have all the details of all the countries. But what I want to talk about today, I think, actually affects us all wherever we live at the moment. Okay, let's just remind ourselves, it was about a year ago, it was in July of last year, that David Cameron, the Prime Minister, who had been in power for a couple of months, made an important speech, and this speech was in Liverpool. And the sorts of things, and I've put in one sort of very brief paragraph here, something that he said. He says, "My great passion is building the big society. It's about people setting up great new schools, charities working to rehabilitate offenders. It's about the biggest, most dramatic redistribution of power from the elites in Whitehall to the man and woman on the street. This is such a powerful idea for blindingly obvious reasons. If it unleashes community engagement, we should do it." So in this speech of his, he talks of people and groups building affordable houses, tackling youth unemployment, and inviting charities to deliver public services. And the Prime Minister's speech was led to the establishment of four pilot areas, one of which was Liverpool, where he made the speech, the others in Eden Vale, the other in Windsor and Maidenhead, and the other in Sutton. But it's had its critics, and I just want to talk about four of those. One was the leader of the Labour Party in Liverpool, which was in power at that time. 7 months after David Cameron made that speech, in February of this year, Liverpool withdrew from the scheme. They withdrew from the Big Society pilot. And Mr. Anderson, who is the leader of the Labour Party in Liverpool, said in a letter to the Prime Minister, "Liverpool has been doing the Big Society for many years. We call it working with our communities, and it is something we are very much committed to." But he went on to say that the loss of more than £100 million of area-based grants in Liverpool has put many organisations at risk. Mr. Anderson asked in his letter, "How can the City Council support the Big Society and its aims to help communities do more for themselves when we all have to cut the lifeline to hundreds of these vital and worthwhile groups?" He continues, I therefore come to the conclusion that Liverpool City Council can no longer support the Big Society initiative as a direct consequence of your funding decisions. So this happened in February. About a month later, another prominent critic of the Big Society was the outgoing director of the Community Services Volunteers, Dame Elizabeth Hoodless. And the CSV, for those who I'm sure you all know, is the largest volunteering charity in the UK. And Dame Elizabeth, who has been involved with the organisation for some 36 years, said there was no strategic plan to the Big Society on what she termed were massive cuts in council budgets were going to make it harder for people to do more in their communities. And then more recently, we've got two other critics. One is the Dr. Rowan Williams, who is the Archbishop of Canterbury, and you probably saw it got quite a lot of press coverage in the newspapers. He wrote an editorial in the weekly magazine New Statesman, and he went to question the ideological roots of the notion of the Big Society, saying that the majority of the changes to services and resources, such as the NHS and universities, were not what people voted for. But he was also very even-handed, if you read the editorial, very even-handed, and asked what the left would do that was different, and what left-inspired localism might look like. And then a very recent critic has been Stacky Beaver, who is a youth worker at a project called Base 33, which is in David Cameron's constituency of Witney in Oxfordshire. Now, the Prime Minister has praised the work going on at the Youth Club, which is a charity, saying it is inspirational and held it as one of his favourite examples of the Big Society. The centre deals with many challenging young people, and the project has been credited with a 20% drop in local antisocial behaviour. However, it was revealed last week the centre is likely to close as it needs to find £7,500 to pay its rent, wages, electricity bill for the month ahead. In its last statement, it was revealed that it was over £30,000 in the red. The centre managers have blamed the funding gap on a combination of local authority cuts and a significant drop in public giving, despite being one of the country's wealthiest local authorities. Stacky Beaver has said that if the centre closed, it would have a massive impact on Witney. For a lot of young people, that's their home. That's where they get all their support, and it's a safe place for them. And she continued, in the past, David Cameron has always come in to say he loves the work that we've done. He nominated us for an award, so obviously values our work that we do. But added, Base 33 is supposed to be an example of the Big Society, but unless we expect everyone to work for free, it's not going to work, is it? So we can see, therefore, that there has been a great deal of criticism about the Big Society, and the notion in some people's minds is that it's flaky and imprecise, but I think this is a big mistake. I think that the government know exactly what they're doing, and they are very clear what they want to achieve, and that's what I want to talk about today. Right, let's just have a look at some of the things that have happened in relation to the Big Society. And some of this you may know, and some of this you may be new to you. But the major one of the major policy ideas of the 2010 Tory Party general election manifesto was the Big Society, and it now forms part of the legislative programme of the Tory Lib Dem coalition agreement. So let's be clear about this, that this is something that both the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats are owning. And what they're suggesting, or they're going to legislate for, is that there's going to be something called the Big Society Bank. And this is where the four major UK banks, plus Santander, have agreed to add £200 million to the funding of this bank. And another £100 million is coming from dormant bank accounts. And this will be used to fund projects. So you can apply to the bank, to the big society bank, and get funds for community groups. But the projects will be able to borrow money, but they will have to pay it back, and they'll have to pay it back with interest. A second thing that happened was that at the time of the launch of the Big Society in July of last year, Lord Way, the Conservative peer and social entrepreneur, was made responsible for the whole notion of the Big Society. He was called the Big Society Czar by the newspapers. However, in February of this year, after only a few months in unpaid post, he resigned. In the months leading up to then, he had reduced his time commitment to the role from 3 days to 2 days. The post has since been scrapped. Tessa Jowell, the Labour MP and Shadow Cabinet member, said of Lord Way's resignation, "No doubt everyone will wish Nat Way well, but yet again, the Big Society is descending into farce. Only a day after Cameron told us all to take more responsibility, it appears that there will now be nobody in government responsible for bringing the Big Society into reality." And then finally, there is somebody in charge. It's Francis Maude, who is the Tory MP. He's the Minister in the Cabinet Office and Paymaster General, and he's now coordinating the government's work on the Big Society. But just to remind you that Francis Maude is at this very moment leading the government's negotiations with the trade union movement to increase the payment teachers, local authority employees and other civil servants pay into their pension pots. Is also leading on reducing the benefits for retiree public employees and wants workers to work longer for their pensions. What has happened? Right. In England, we've got something called Locality, which is a new nationwide network of community-led organisations, which are going to carry out a great deal of the work that the government is calling community organising. They're calling it not community development, but community organising. And they've set up an institute for community organising. They've got identified 10 areas, some are ready to go, as they say. One is in Birmingham, one is in London, one is in Bristol, one is in Cornwall, and one is in Norfolk. And at the same time, they've set up a training programme for 5,000 community organisers. 500 of these will be full-time and will be trained. And in their first year, they will receive a bursary of £20,000. Then afterwards, they will have to raise their own salary. So you get £20,000, you get training, you go out into the community, and part of your job is to raise your own salary. That these community organisers, as they're going to be called, will be expected to act as a catalyst for community action at a neighbourhood level. They will help their communities take advantage of other big society initiatives, such as the right to buy community assets and the right to bid to run public services. And these will be supported by 4,500 part-time and voluntary organisers. And the 10 areas mentioned are committed to recruiting organisers and to hosting them. And the organisers will have access to facilities, other groups and charities, mentoring and support, and financial resources. Okay, so what are the main themes as seen from the position of the government in relation to the Big Society and what it means for professionals? Well, if you look at the white papers that they have produced, it's very interesting. There are three main areas, three themes, if you like. And they demonstrate what the government is trying to do in quite a lot of detail. And I'll just paraphrase some of these for you. They're talking about more freedom to exercise judgment. There will be greater freedom for decision, and these are the words of the government, there will be greater freedom for decisions to be made at a local level by professionals who are held to account directly by citizens as service users. Centralised controls of services will be reduced as they are seen as bureaucratic and wasteful, so there will be an end to comprehensive area assessments, ending central performance targets, and end ring fencing of funds. There will be new innovative models to deliver services locally, which will be encouraged and give citizens and professionals more ownerships. There will be encouragement of mutuals, cooperatives, social enterprise, and the voluntary sector. More public services will be delivered through small local autonomous units, for instance, GP commissioners, which is part of the Health and Social Care Bill, schools working outside local authorities, which is very much what Michael Gove wants, and new mutuals. These new providers will set their own terms and conditions, which may or may not be linked to national frameworks. Professionals will be dispersed through many smaller organisations. They will need to have access to effective professional bodies to provide them with collective voice, status, and credibility. Second point, new approaches to accountability. There will be new models for service delivery which emphasise user voice and choice. New, more direct relationships are likely to develop between the professionals and those that they serve. For instance, patients being part of members of National Health Foundation trusts, mutuals jointly owned and run by young people and professionals. And professionals will need to manage and regulate their own affairs. According to the government, inspection is likely to be reduced or even removed. Professionals will become more dependent on their professional bodies and associations for guidance on best practice and continuing professional development. So that will remove a whole tier of organisations which at the moment are engaged in inspection and regulation. And then finally, they want to achieve greater efficiency and lower cost. The old top-down system of targets and central micromanagement will be replaced. Reduction of quangos, combining administration and services for greater efficiency, and mutualization of public services and functions. Services without a statutory mandate will be dramatically scaled back and in some areas abolished. Voluntary and private sectors will be expected to take up the slack. Those parts of the professional services that can be delivered by para-professionals with lower levels of training are likely to expand. So this is an important feature for us as professionals. The fully trained professionals will support these staff at the same time as doing the work that requires their particular expertise. So these are some of the themes that government is intent on getting through in the next 5 years. So we can ask the question, is all of this that I've just outlined, which I've had to do very briefly, is it new? Is it different? Well, I think we can look at it in three different ways. The first thing to say that this idea of the new society, the big society, comes from Cameron's idea of the broken society. He talked about the broken society in July 2007 when an 11-year-old boy, Rhys Jones, died from a gunshot wound in Liverpool. You probably all remember. An incident that shocked everybody. The newspapers were full of the story. And David Cameron used that because to talk about what he called the... He wanted to tackle anarchy in the UK. He spoke of gang killings, knife crime, social breakdown, and the need for individuals to take more responsibility. At this time, David Cameron was arguing that the top-down targets and solutions approach of New Labour was stifling the forces that made society work. But this comes out of what Tony Blair was talking about with the third way. If you remember, not long after Tony Blair was elected, or the New Labour was elected and Tony Blair was Prime Minister in 1997, he, with Anthony Giddens, who was professor of sociology at the LSE, launched what they called a debate around the third way, which was that there is a middle way, if you like, between the state and the market. And this legitimated very clearly in Britain the idea of a mixed economy of welfare, where both private and the public sector would deliver welfare, particularly in the health service. But it's clearly going to roll out over the next few months and few years across all of the services. And then finally, Cameron has been influenced by Philip Blond, who wrote a book in last year, 2010, called How Left and Right Have Broken Britain and How We Can Fix It. And Philip Blond is a political writer and thinker and author of the book. He argues in the book, it's well worth having a look at, that citizens should take greater responsibility for their own welfare and by promoting civic responsibility and volunteerism in their local community. Well, when I studied social policy many years ago, one of the things that I learned during my many hours of listening to lectures was that one of the key messages of social policy, which is what the big society is all about, is that it's the handmaiden of economic policy. And it's impossible to look at something like the big society without checking out what's going on in the wider field, on the economic front. What's happening recently? Well, Mervyn King, who's not known to be the biggest of doves around in the bank or in the financial sector, and he, speaking in March this year, said that the recession that we're going through is due completely to the banks and to the financial sector. Why do banks in general have to pay bonuses? Answer, this is what he said, answer, they know that if they get into difficulties, the state will bail them out. And in this article, which was, I think it was published in The Observer, he thinks that the underlying problem for the UK economy is still there, and that there could be a repeat of the financial crisis. This is why he votes against the interest rates. As he argues, it would interest rate rises. As he argues, it would lead to a further recession, which would put more people out of work. Houses would be repossessed, more people would be drawing benefits, and there would be less consumer and corporate spending. So what we've got at the moment is the largest banking crisis in memory. I think we have to remember this. Last year, the government borrowed 11.1% of national income. The previous highest was after the Second World War, when we were borrowing at 7.7. So we're borrowing more money than we were after the Second World War. And on top of that, we are seeing that the government is planning the largest reduction in borrowing over the next 5 years. And this is what the impact is on the economy. We've seen clearly the financial restraint in the public sector, cuts in benefit levels, particularly housing benefit. Pension ages are rising, so people will have to work longer before they can claim their state pension. The child benefit is being cut and to higher rate payers, so if you're to be a higher rate payer, taxpayer, you have to be earning over £44,000 a year, and that will be removed, your child benefit, if you have children, from April 2013. And in the meantime, as those with children know, child benefit is frozen. During 2010, 66,000 local authority workers lost their jobs, of which 45,000 of those were lost in the final 3 months of last year. Alongside this, the public sector pay increases have been frozen for 2 years, and in the budget of this year, the government stated they agreed with Lord Hutton's review and conclusion on withdrawing the final pension final salary pensions for public sector employees, such as nurses and teachers. And we've seen the other things that I've got put up there. We've seen tax levels increase for VAT to 20%. We've got increased unemployment. It's now at 7.7%. And if you're a 16 to 24-year-old, you'll be experiencing unemployment at the rate of 23.3%. These are the latest figures. Annual inflation in May was 4.75%, and economic growth is at 17%. But what George Osborne says, he said, the Chancellor of Exchequer, if things go according to plan, the bulk of Britain's peacetime deficit will have disappeared by the end of this Parliament. That's to 2015. The financial markets will give the UK some thumbs up. There will be a re-energised private sector that will take the place of a shrunken public sector, which will be the engine of growth. And he claims that the North will grow economically as rapidly as the South, and the coalition government will reap big political dividends at the next election. The Labour Party, on the other hand, claim that the austerity measures are unnecessary, and the government must think again on the speed and scale of the cuts, which go too deep and too fast, which they say is choking off growth, increasing unemployment, and making it harder to reduce the deficit in the long term. They point to the Treasurer's own figures released after the March budget, which shows that the average family will be worse off by around £400 a year once all tax and benefit changes are taken into account. So that's the background in which this social policy, the big society, has been created. Well, the question that we can ask is, will the big society work? And I pose three questions here. And if we look at these individually, as most of us know, we have in this country massive and growing inequalities. In terms of wealth, we now have figures published by the government of last year that show that the poorest 50% of the population owns only 6% of the wealth, whilst the richest 5% own 40% of the wealth. And furthermore, and again, according to government statistics, 69%, we'll say it's 70%, of all land in the UK is owned by 0.3% of the population. If we look at income, we can see similar patterns with growing inequality. For example, in the year 2008-09, the top one-fifth of income earners received 43% of all income. Different governments have made attempts to redistribute wealth and income more equally. However, there is no reference to addressing inequalities or social divisions of any kind in anything that I've read about the ideas of the new society. The big society reviews all communities as similar and comparable and fails to recognize the diversity of communities and the considerable and growing economic inequalities in the UK. So this approach, this big society approach, has much in common with the Victorian philosophy, which was saw community as mutual aid, charity, and voluntarism, and promoted individual responsibility in what they called in Victorian time the poor and the dangerous classes. The second point, will strategies of inclusion and localism become subordinate to the management of highly differentiated and socially divided populations? Well, localism and inclusion in themselves are not bad drivers for social policy, but the reality is that the central government will always want to manage its citizens, and it's unlikely that local will win out over centralism. For example, at the moment, the central government is deciding on the size of the different reduced expenditure pots of its departments for local and local authorities are left deciding where to spend and where to cut and what to ration. So what is the role for community development and the welfare state? Well, some of you here, I know quite a lot about community development, and others perhaps know only a little bit. So I just want to briefly say what community development does. And of course, there's lots of different definitions of community development. And what I offered here is one which pulls together some of the main strands. And these are very general strands as well. One is that community development is helps people see that they have common concerns about local or other public issues that they could benefit from by working together. And it helps them, and the second point, it helps them to work together to achieve independent community groups, supporting them to plan and take action and encourage evaluation and reflection as a way of improving effectiveness. The third thing it does, it supports and develops networking between communities and independent groups across the community sector and between the voluntary sector and the statutory sector. And very importantly, it promotes values of equity, inclusiveness, social justice, participation, and cooperation. And the fifth point is that it empowers people and their organizations to influence and transform public policies and services and other factors affecting their lives. And then finally, it advises and informs local authorities, public authorities, on community perspectives and assists them to strengthen communities and work in genuine partnership with them. So if that works effectively, the outcomes can be quite considerable. And I think, although it's very difficult to quantify the impact of community development, I think a good community development worker knows when he or she has been successful. And it's generally about being facilitating and empowering the activities. And one is that it should reduce isolation and alienation of community members. I mean, a lot of people, and I'm sure this is true of us in this room, may not know, unless they've lived there for some time in the community, may not know their neighbours. They may not know people in the same street as themselves or in the same area as themselves. We live very different sorts of lives to our parents. People work on shifts. They go in and out of the house at different times. Different houses are occupied by different family units or individuals. So there's a sense in which people don't feel part of the communities in which they inhabit or the neighbourhoods in which they inhabit. And there's a very important book, I'm sure you're aware of it, by Robert Putman called Bowling Alone, which was published in 2000. And American writer, he points to most Western countries, including the US and the UK, having declining social capital. And that's the second point here, is part of community development is trying to increase social capital. And by social capital, I mean social connections and knowledge that helps people to achieve their ambitions and goals and extends their power and influence. It also increases participation and collaboration. Community development also improves people's confidence. It develops their practical skills, it increases their verbal skills, it increases their knowledge, their political understandings, and they become therefore more effective in their community. And hopefully it will improve the facilities and conditions in that locality, whether that's to make a community feel safer, a community feel more wanted to be lived in. And it should improve the delivery of public services. And then finally, should raise awareness of what it is that's going on in the wider sphere, in the social, economic, political systems and power. Right, the government's push for the big society cannot be dismissed as a publicity stunt, which is what I've said earlier. I think it has to be treated very, very seriously. It actually has substance, and behind the slick title, there lies real impact on our communities and neighbourhoods. We therefore have to take this opportunity in community development to take a fresh look at everything and to really consider what community development means and what it can achieve in a period of economic austerity. When the economy is booming and social institutions are working well, we feel confident. But equally, there is a vagueness and a complacency on social issues. We say, oh, well, society will look after them. And I think when things are on the down, which they are at the moment, it's a real opportunity to look very clearly at what we believe in and what we stand for. And, you know, though circumstances are difficult, change can be energizing and refreshing. It can make people think in different ways. And I think people do want changes. And I put there possible new funding streams. Well, yes and no. We're seeing massive cuts in public sector and voluntary sector funding, but it could be that there will be opportunities that will come to light which will enable certain groups to continue. However, the challenges for community development are enormous. It won't be easy. There is a reduction and will be a further reduction in funding and community resources. Groups and organisations have disappeared and will disappear, whether they're large or small. One of the challenges will be getting the right organisers or the right volunteers into providing appropriate training and support in organisations. There's a good deal of cynicism around at the moment. Much of it came from the MPs and the House of Lords expenses scandal. However, there has been a lot of anger that's led to a lot of campaigning. Many young people are now using social networking sites. There's been, certainly in London, where I live, lots of demonstrations against companies and shops in the Sir Philip Green's empire. Maybe it have been in Scotland and elsewhere, Topshop and so on, where because people are complaining that Philip Green and his organisations are avoiding tax that could be used for the services that people need. And finally, I put being seen as agents of the state. Community developments has always had this problem. Which side are we on? Are you on the side of the state? Are you on the side of the people? Well, I think it really goes back to you're working in and against the state. You have to be clear of the agenda that you're working to. And also we're working in and against, clearly, the market at the moment. So one of the things that I think that I've mentioned, and one of the things I've mentioned today, is this growing disparity between the rich and the poor in the United Kingdom. And all the evidence points to us becoming a very unequal society. And this is a major problem that the big society fails to address. In fact, it can be argued, conversely, that the government's adherence to neoliberal economics will make the situation worse. More people will be in poverty and the rich will become richer. So the present time is a golden opportunity to think and act differently. And I've suggested two books here, and some of you will, I'm sure, be familiar with them. The Impact of Inequality, How to Make Sick Societies Healthier, by Richard Wilkinson. Richard Wilkinson is Professor of Social Epidemiology at the Nottingham Medical School, and he puts forward indisputable evidence that unequal societies create poor health, more social conflict, and more violence. Comparing the USA with market economies and states, and one state with another, Wilkinson shows that how inequality leads to stress, which creates sickness in the individual and on a mass level, and society overall suffers widespread unhappiness and high levels of violence, depression, and mistrust across the whole of the social spectrum. He argues that relatively small amounts of small reductions in inequality can make an important difference. And then the other book that I would recommend, The Spirit Level, this one here. I suspect some of you will have seen it. It's a bestseller at the moment. Why Equality is Better for Everyone. And I just want to read very briefly from the book, because I think it gives us some hope. Modern societies will depend increasingly on being creative, adaptable, inventive, well-informed, and flexible communities, able to respond generously to each other and to needs wherever they arise. Those are characteristics not of societies in hoc to the rich, in which people are driven by status and insecurities, but of populations used to working together and respecting each other as equals. And because we are trying to grow the new society within the old. Our values and the work we and the way we work must be part of how we bring a new society into being. But we must also try to bring about a shift in public values, so that instead of inspiring admiration and envy, conspicuous consumption is seen as part of the problem, a sign of greed and unfairness which damages society and the planet. And then finally, there's a book by Robert Peston, who's on the telly nearly every night these days. He's the BBC business editor, and I do recommend the book Who Runs Britain. I picked it up in an Oxfam bookshop and haven't put it down since. It provides a very good analysis of what's going on at the moment. If you want a clear, analysis, you're not an economist, I'm certainly not, it tells you what's going on. It's very good. And he argues that the super rich, who benefited under New Labour and now the Conservative Lib Dem coalition, have undermined the fabric of the democratic state. And I'll just briefly quote what he says. And he's thinking forward. Possible in the UK in 10 years' time, public services will be cracking for the lack of resources, as the burden of tax falls on a dwindling number of private sector employees whose skills aren't quite rare enough or valuable enough to take them into the top league of globally mobile earners. And year after year, the real disposable income of the majority would be squeezed ever so slightly, because that would be the only way that they could keep their jobs in a climate of intense international competition and endured by their respective employers. Meanwhile, the plutocrats who own businesses would shuttle from London to Monaco, to Moscow to Mumbai, to Shanghai to Rio and back again, refusing to pay the subscription price to belong in any meaningful sense to a nation of into a nation of or community, except the global community of the super wealthy. In that world, elected politicians would seem less and less relevant to the daily lives of the majority. So finally, community development is about offering well-tested and tried ways of doing things. It involves working with communities that are damaged, and certainly damaged by the present economic recession. And as we have seen, the changes that are taking place in the UK are systematic and substantial, impacting unequally on different parts of the UK and different members of the UK population. So in order to take community development forward, we need to be brave, we need to think differently, we need to think creatively and work creatively and develop new ways of working and engaging with local communities and powerful stakeholders. Finally, localism has an important part in a modern society, and as myself, as a former community development worker and a strong advocate of community development, I welcome moves towards working in and with communities and cutting out centralism. However, as a commentator on social policy and as a teacher in higher education, I'm also aware that whilst we have powerful forces like neoliberal economic policies, powerful vested interests both in Parliament and in the financial sector, the ideas of the big society are not going to deliver the sort of society most of us in this hall would like to see. Our job is to critique the national and international social, economic and political forces that are creating the circumstances we work and live in, and offer solutions for real, sustainable, progressive change. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith, for that very full and complete analysis of the big society concept. Thank you very much indeed. We've got about 15 minutes or so for questions and discussion on the issues that Keith raised in his presentation and any others that you want to raise before we go to our round table. So don't be shy. Who wants to kick off? Can you just say your name and also where you're from, because I think that would be helpful.
Tony Acton, member of the FACE Executive, and I had the pleasure of working in community development briefly with Keith in a former life, and I know Keith's personal commitment to these areas. But frankly, I don't doubt the sincerity of the Prime Minister. I'm sure he believes himself. And I do take very seriously the point you made about social inequality and the financial issues. But at the end of the day, do you think destroying all the structures that, you know, government offices, for instance, regional development agencies, and all manner of things, with the expertise of people who are often discarded on the basis of their backroom staff, is a word we hear a lot. Do you think all of that is going to actually damage the capacity of society to move forward?
Ask me in a few years' time. I don't know. I mean, I think the key is that what this government, and certainly the last government, and we know more about the last government than we do this government, is that they didn't tackle the inequalities that there were. I think that what community development did under New Labour, and you and I did some research together on the Thornhill residence, which I thought was really very interesting. When we, you know, for those unfamiliar, it's an estate in Southampton. It's social housing, few social facilities, high rates of unemployment. Things were on the skids, really. And the government, they nominated 39 areas in the country where they poured in substantial amounts of money, about £50 million into each community, £5 million for 10 years. And the purpose was to raise the levels, expectation levels of people, so that they could respond more effectively and improve the facilities. And this was a further way of working, and they did do all the things that you just said and had area-based local regional offices and so on. But in my view, what New Labour did and this government is not even doing, what they did was they didn't really listen to what people wanted or said. What they wanted was an answer to particular questions that they asked. So you had a situation where people didn't really feel, other than particular community members, who were very, very bought the idea, very much became chair of the residence groups and organized playground facilities and so on and so forth. But for a lot of people, they were not, their questions were not addressed. And I think that's the problem, is that community development, when it comes from central government in that form, it's very tight, very tight in the way that it is organized. And it doesn't allow people to say what they want. So we've got to do lots of things. One is we've got to, as a society, say, yes, we want to have good community development, and we need it in this particular way. And also, on a wider level, are we prepared to continue to have the inequalities that are now in the UK, which have led, according to people like Wilkinson and Pickett, to add to the social stress, levels of violence, mental health issues, etc. I mean, it's a convincing argument they're putting. I don't agree with all of it, but certainly in those societies where they are more equal, there are examples of improvements in people's health and well-being. Probably not answering your question at all, Tony, but it's nice to have a question.
Thank you. Question down here, and then one over here. So if you want to bring the mic down to Colin in the front, and then Pete next over here.
I think just in case, Colin, it's just helpful. Thank you.
Two things really. One is a sort of partial response to what Tony had to say, in terms of the Prime Minister's sincerity. From where I'm standing, by the way, I'm Colin Trotman, and I'm Professor of Continuing Education at Swansea University. It's It's not a question of sincerity for me, it's a question of ideology. And Keith mentioned earlier on Rowan Atkinson. Rowan Atkinson. Rowan Williams, a fellow Welshman, I'm very pleased to say, who in that article in the New Statesman also pointed out something which I think is fundamentally essential to this debate. The Tory-led coalition has no political mandate for the changes that they're introducing. That wasn't in the manifesto. No one voted on that. They don't have a political mandate. In terms of where I'm from in South Wales, there's no mandate at all. I mean, whatever changes they're going to win. So it's in that sense, it's more about ideology than sincerity in terms of he thinks he's doing a good job. This is what they want to do. But in relation to Keith, can I thank you for an excellent presentation? I thoroughly enjoyed it. Very important what you have to say to us. And my what I'd like to hear, Keith, is your views really on where adult education fits into this. Because I mean, I think most of us would accept that adult education can be life changing. It's about political change, it's about social change, it should be student-centred, and it's about giving people those chances. So, largely, I mean, I agree with everything you have to say, really, and your analysis, but I'd like to hear more in terms of how adult education should be brought into this process, and how we should be pushing it more, really, in terms of
Yeah. Thank you very much, and thanks for your words of praise. I'm although I've got this fancy title, Professor of Social Work, I mean, I actually left school at 15. For me, adult education is a very personal thing because it was a way that I achieved what I've got today, I suppose, because I went to work at 15 doing very mundane sort of jobs, and through evening classes, I then went to do a certificate course, and then I did a university program later, and so on and so forth. So I'm a great believer in it, and it concerns me that adult education has been so severely cut back by successive governments, really. And when you think that the previous Labour government, a number of the people in that had actually used adult education to themselves to achieve what they achieved, then I think it's awful. I mean, it does, you know, this is part of the cuts, I suppose, is that if we're going to succeed in developing society, and I don't have any political position, you know, I find it all very disturbing the way that political parties operate, so I don't have any particular political party. I do think that if we're going to achieve a better society, and I think that's what we all want, then we've got to have things where people who don't succeed particularly well at school, for instance, or want to improve on what they've learnt at school and learn more at different stages in their life, their lifelong learning, then that's got to be there for them. And it's got to be properly resourced. It can't be, oh, it's something extra to do.
Thanks, Keith. I think Pete here, microphone. Where's microphone?
Pete Jones, Staffordshire University. A weird sort of question. Thank you very much for that, Keith. Very nice. When you were talking about social capital and empowerment and community, I think my question really is, how do we safeguard the interests of the outsider or the isolated? Because quite often, communities a weird beast. Mm-hmm. And I work in Stoke-on-Trent, which has got a big BNP representation, and I live in a rural market town in Shropshire where I stand out a bit because I'm not actually related to anybody, and I wasn't related to my wife before I married her. So
good for you.
How do we safeguard the interests of the outsiders, particularly when some people, the community leaders, in John Shuttleworth's words, you know, it's what I want to become, because when there's a riot or a fire, the media will eagerly seek my opinion. How do we stop the community discriminating against the outsider or the isolated? And also, how do we safeguard that those people who aren't empowered, who don't have the social capital, actually take advantage of the big society idea to represent their own interests?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a big question. Big society, big question. It's always been a problem, and the skilled community development worker will try hard to resolve that one. I think the difference between working in a community and being an experienced community development worker, if you like, is that there are values associated with it, and I think that's the key, is that the values of community development are, as I said earlier, about equality, about inclusiveness, which does try and deal with exclusiveness. It's to deal with social justice, and it's deal with participation. But there is no doubt that organizations like the BNP and other right-wing organizations will hijack, or try and hijack, or local organizations for their own ends and try and take it in a particular direction. Because some of the arguments that they put forward can be, for some people, persuasive, because it seems to be very black and white, if you like. It certainly can try and answer some of the questions that they, what's going on? Why am I losing a job? Why are the schools being cut, etc., etc.? Oh, well, the reason is, and they give them an answer. And I think it's, as we, these things are not like that. You know, it's much more complex. And it's also much more, I think it demands people actually saying what we've got is not very good, actually, if it is that we're getting a society where resources for the rich or for the better off are greater in number than those for poorer communities. It seems to me that's an inequality in the system. So you have to put that forward as an ideal that you want to achieve that with local people. Now, it comes a time maybe when you're working with a group, if they are supporting a particular brand of political ideology that you don't agree with, because it does exclude people, it does scapegoat others, then I think you just withdraw. You know, if you've tried your best, you have to withdraw. But I know it's very difficult, and I'm sure, I don't know Stoke-on-Trent, but I can imagine from what I've read in the newspapers, things must be very difficult for at the moment, and probably in other areas as well. You know, a bit like parts of North East London, you know, have got similar problems. Well, John will know that.
Yeah, Pete, you do.
Yeah.
Let's not go there. Jim?
Yeah. Jim Tate from the University of West of England in Bristol. Following on, really, from what Pete's saying, I'd like to ask whether community engagement favours some community identities over others. You're using words like localism, local communities. They're geographical terms. You mentioned that the alienated individual.
Mm.
But some people have community identities that are not geographical.
Yeah, sure.
You might be a member of a community that's an online community.
Yeah, sure.
That has no geographical basis.
Sure, sure.
Or your community identity might relate to your sexuality or something like that.
Mm.
And I'm wondering how many people get excluded as a result of their community identity not being geographically located.
Mm.
And also the level of social embedding. Because, for example, if you were, say, a member of a Muslim community in Tower Hamlets in South London, you might share a social identity with your neighbours. It might be quite an organised community. You'll have community leaders, and those community leaders may be quite politically savvy, and they'll be able to take advantage of this kind of community engagement. But you may not belong to that kind of highly dense community. And I'm just wondering about who's excluded and what kind of community identities does this disfavor?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. I mean, you know, Putman's book, you know, The Bowling Alone, does demonstrate exactly what you said. More and more people feeling less engaged in the communities in which they live for all sorts of reasons, usually because of the nature of the work that they do, the family units they're part of, and so on. So, and certainly when I talk with students, you know, I do sessions on what community means in a sort of complex way that you've outlined. And, you know, a lot of students who have lived, you know, these are students who have lived in the same area for a number of years, they're mature students, and they don't know their next door neighbours, and that's not unusual. So, you're right, there are these other communities, because I think there is a sense in our humanness, if you like, that needs and wants to be part of a group and part of something wider than your family or yourself, even. You want to be accepted, you want to feel that you can contribute in some way and get things from things. So you will become, I think, most people will want to become part of communities which relate to their identity very often, and it can be also related to an interest they have and so on, whatever it is. And I think we're much more likely to have that. And as I mentioned earlier, the Facebook communities, the social networking communities, which have done so much in the Arab Spring and now in Britain, in the UK, in trying to develop campaigns, does demonstrate to me, and there's lots and lots of evidence now, that IT is actually bringing particularly young people together in communities that others don't see. They often see it as an escape. People go into their bedroom and escape from the world. In fact, they're actually communicating with a range of communities that they're part of and meet up with people. So I think you're right. I think we're going through a very, very interesting stage in this country, and I'm sure in other countries as well, where ideas of community and neighbourhood are being swept aside. That's not to say they don't exist, but I think they're becoming less important to other sorts of communities. I mean, you might want to call a face, a community, or maybe that's what will be happening over the next 3 days.
Okay. I think that's a really good note to finish on. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I think you want to join with me as well to thank Keith again for a really stimulating and provocative presentation. I mean, that's come across in the debate we've had. So can we thank Keith very much indeed. Thank you.